This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I mean, for a start, twice as many people vote in a general election as do in a typical local election. So you have a different and much bigger electorate. And people get the point that, well, although obviously they're voting for the individual candidate, they're also helping select the government of the day. And in all elections, that tends to mean that the smaller parties do less well at a general election than they do at local elections.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In a week, Dover MP Natalie Elphick hogged the headlines. Controversial red route restrictions were introduced in Medway, and there's bad news on bus passes. I'm Simon Finley, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Dan Essen, who covers the borough and district councils.
Hello.
And Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
And we're also joined by KM Group political editor Paul Francis, who'll be bringing us his weekly Westminster Watch.
Hello.
And our special guest is former Deputy Prime Minister and veteran Ashford MP Damien Green, who lifts the lid on what the Tories thought when Dover MP Natalie Elphick sensationally quit the party last week. First up is Dan. What's been happening down your way?
So I've actually got a bit of a scoop into the life and times of one Natalie Elphick of recent defection fame. It relates to a planning application she put to Dover District Council around her house back at Christmas time in 2022, which had still not been decided on.
Okay, what did she apply for and why has it taken so long?
So in short, back on, I think it was Christmas Eve 2022, in fact, she put in a planning application to demolish the garage of her former constituency home in St Margaret's Bay and build a two-bedroom cottage on it. The actual home itself, four-bed detached one, was sold in 2022 on for just over $1.5 million, but she still owns the garage, hence the planning application. Basically, it sits on a very narrow hill, and her planning consultants have been locked in a back and forth with the county council's transport team for well over a year now. The transport team and quite a few locals say that the parking arrangements aren't safe because of how narrow the road is, but Elphick's people say there's not been a crash there for over 20 years and that there's basically no problem with the plans. Well, we already knew all of that, but just the other day she told me that she's actually going to withdraw the application and resubmit it after the general election, so it will be considered purely on its merits, she said.
Mm-hmm. What's the reason for that then?
So basically, she said it's disappointing that some people have tried to link the planning application to her role as an MP, and it's gotten more scrutiny because of that. And since she'll be standing down at the general election, she'll then put the planning application back in to be sure that it's treated exactly the same as anyone put in by any member of the public. Though she did stress to me it's exactly the sort of brownfield site that everyone seems to agree should be used for housing. And housing is, of course, her sort of main policy interest. She's already advising Labour on housing policy, so maybe her experience with Dover District Council's planning department might feed into that in some small way.
Robert, what's been happening in Medway?
So two bits for me this week. The first is the Chatham Docks application, which we discussed for the past couple of weeks. It was deferred, and we now know that the legal challenge from the businesses on the site is down to four main points. They are that the plans would restrict access to the wider site, that planning officers have allegedly misinterpreted policies from Medway's 2003 local plan and the National Planning Policy Framework, that the application requires an environmental assessment, which hasn't been done, and that officers haven't properly considered the economic impacts. Now, planning officers say they don't see much basis for these claims and will amend the officer's report to reflect that. However, the Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities is still considering the separate request for a call-in on the application, which means there's an Article 31 direction, which means that the plans can't move forward until that's removed, when Michael Gove will make a decision about whether he needs to get involved.
And I believe the other news this week is something you've covered a fair bit, but red routes.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, just for a brief explainer on what red routes are, they're basically a harsher version of double yellow lines, where there's no stopping at any other time apart from if you have a blue disabled badge. So these are enforced by smart cameras, and they're on five routes in Medway: the A2 Raynham High Street, the Brooks Best Street, Corporation Street and Star Hill. So they'll come into effect in Medway from May 20th after the red lines went down on the five routes they're supposed to be implemented in last week. It's been a topic of debate which has been rumbling on for a while, first having been suggested in late 2022 by the then Tory administration. It's been through consultations, debated at council meetings, called into overview and scrutiny, and finally it's about to start next week. However, despite all this noise, many residents were taken by surprise and didn't know the red lines were coming or what they even meant. For the first 6 months of the red routes, drivers who break the rules will receive a warning letter the first time, followed by a £70 fine if they break the rules again, reduced to £35 if paid within a discounted period. So what's been happening at County Hall, Simon?
Well, it's bad news for parents on the horizon. Kent County Council is proposing an increase to the cost of the Kent Travel Saver. That's a bus pass to you and me. The cost of the for term 2024 to 2025 will increase £100 to £550 per pass. That's over 18% at the time when the inflation rate is around about 3.5%.
So what's the explanation for the big jump?
Well, two things. Firstly, it has to be said that about 15,000 of these passes are issued to children every year. KCC has received a subsidy from the Department of Transport, which has largely expired, and it actually held the cost for about 2 years at £450. And the charges are dictated by the bus companies, who are passing on inflationary pressures that they say that they're experiencing.
Now, I can't imagine this is particularly popular, so what's the political fallout from this?
Well, the Labour Party and the Greens are, you know, obviously making hay. The Labour Party says it's a stealth tax, and the Greens are claiming it will force more parents to abandon the bus and use the car instead. But the KCC's Conservative Transport Committee Chairman, Sean Holden, said that few, if any, local authorities these days actually subsidise their bus passes, and he also makes pains to point out that low-income families will get a pass at a much cheaper rate of £120, which won't be changing. Turning to KM Political Editor Paul Francis. Paul, another interesting week in national politics.
Yes, well, the issue dominating the headlines continues to be the defection of Natalie Elphick from the Conservatives to the Labour Party. Now, Starmer thought he'd got a coup there by attracting someone who was never on anyone's list as a potential defector, but Embrace is apparently Labour's programme on lots of issues. And I think what was going on here was that Labour felt that by encouraging her to join them as a member of the Labour Party would send a message out to other Conservatives who are perhaps disaffected, disillusioned with the party, and saying, well, this we can accommodate you despite our differences.
It's been interesting the way it's been received. The Tories are now all describing her as hard right. Sounds rhymes with far right, doesn't it?
Yes.
People obviously trying to sort of tarnish her in that way. But one Labour councillor I spoke to this week said, I know the Labour Party is a broad church, but we don't take atheists.
And as Neil Kinnock said, broad churches have walls as well.
Yes.
So I think this is a judgment call, which I think Starmer perhaps got wrong this occasion. He might have just been able to say, well, we had an approach from the Conservative MP, Natalie Elphick, who wanted to join us. We considered the request and decided her values didn't align with ours. And so we said no. Mm. And saying no sometimes is a good tactical ploy.
Yeah. OK, meanwhile, there's been another spat between Dover health officials and the government over biosecurity checks. That sounds vaguely familiar.
Yes, there's been a long-running dispute between DEFRA and the Port of Dover Health Authority about the introduction of these new checks, which all stem from the UK's departure from the European Union, and an argument basically about where these checks ought to be taking place. Now, Dover thinks the checks need to be taking place at Dover, rather than at the Sevington site near Ashford, which is some 22 miles away. Now, the situation is quite complicated, but there's been a letter published by the Port of Dover Health Authority to the Select Committee looking into this matter, saying that DEFRA is deliberately misrepresenting its views and is doing so because they're trying to justify the use of Sevington, which is the Sevington site, which is 22 miles away from the Port of Dover, to carry out these checks. Now, whether there's going to be another inquiry into this is not yet decided, but the government's feeling a bit of heat from the health authority.
OK, Paul, thank you very much indeed, and that wraps up our contributions for the moment. This week, the so-called Tory Minister for Common Sense, Esther McVeigh, appeared to want to ban civil servants from wearing rainbow lanyards or any other symbol perceived to be a political statement. These days, we seem to have rainbow laces on semi-professional footballers, with police cars in rainbow colours, hospital, car park, zebra crossing is done up in rainbow colours. Was this political posturing by Esther McVeigh, or was it a swipe at the Woke Brigade, or was it just trying to connect with the Tory core vote. Right, what are your feelings on this then, young Dan?
So, I mean, SOT is self-evidently political posturing, but there is also a substantive policy issue at question, I think many would say. The argument many would make, maybe not in this exact fashion, would be that for civil servants to wear, for example, you know, pride lanyards, rainbow lanyards, or that kind of thing, is to express or concede sympathy with or the relevance of a particular view of the world and gender and sexuality, which is of itself a political statement. And the whole point of the civil service is that they're not meant to be partial. Civil servants aren't meant to have, or, well, at least aren't meant to allow their own political opinions to have an effect on the way they do their job.
But is that an actual political opinion?
What do you mean?
Well, to wear a rainbow symbol of any kind.
Not necessarily, but I think what many would argue is that it is to express sympathy with a worldview which sees, you know, oppression around gender and sexuality as still a prevalent phenomenon, which is in and of itself a contested political worldview. Because many would point out that, especially in the UK, this is one of the most liberal and tolerant countries on issues of gender and sexuality of any country on earth.
Or is this an estimate by just trying to score a few political points, or was she trying to get sort of, you know, government departments to behave in a more uniformed way when it comes to dress?
Probably a bit of both. I mean, like I said, it is very evidently political posturing. It comes across as the kind of thing you say when you don't really have much of substance to say on substantive issues. You know, civil service reform has been a major issue that you know, everyone from Michael Gove onwards has been quite fixated on, but very little seems to have actually been achieved on it. But, you know, if she's to be believed, she is concerned about the standardisation of behaviour and, you know, dress codes among civil servants. That's not in and of itself an illegitimate, you know, position to have. But you know, the fact that it comes now and it's part of a sort of broader cultural debate does make it look more like political posturing than anything else.
Yeah, when I heard it on the radio, when I heard actually what she said, the Combs hotline came to mind. Which was the dying embers of the John Major administration. What do you reckon then, Paul?
Yeah, well, you've stolen my thunder there. I was about to say, draw an analogy with the Cohn's hotline. I mean, I think the problem for the Tories is that this doesn't necessarily resonate with the core vote, particularly in a way that they think it does. I mean, I think most voters are concerned about the cost of living crisis, the recession, interest rates. They don't spend their time agonising over the design of lanyards. I mean, Esther McVeigh has said that wearing these branded lanyards is an act of political activism, which I just don't see as being a particularly valid characterisation of them, even if some people perhaps think it's a bit over the top.
There does seem to be a bit of a Tory reboot going on at the minute. So the big speech from Rishi Sunak full of gloomy prognostications for the future, if anyone has the temerity to vote anything other than Tory. Then we have the Esther McVeigh speech. I mean, what do you think? Is it going to work, something like this, Rory?
Well, I think, I mean, I agree with Paul in the sense of a lot of people are looking at this and thinking, what is kind of the point? I mean, it's not the top of people's agenda. And as you say, Rishi Sunak kind of is flailing around trying to find a sort of a policy platform, a direction which to put his leadership under. And this kind of just looks a bit, I think a lot of people are saying, like, he's not got really many ideas. One week it's that he's, you know, really fixated on the small boats crisis, which is obviously of big concern to a lot of people, particularly here in Kent. Other week it's inflation, and this week it's lanyards. It used to be in the New Labour days, they had a week for everything, you know, and blocked out and what they were going to talk about. This kind of seems like it's less organised. It's just they've got something different every week and none of it's really coherent.
Yeah, there was New Labour who rolled everything out, didn't they? And, you know, they ever had everything on a grid, etc. So,
yeah. One thing I'd like, a point worth making is that Rishi Sunak is coming under pressure to consider a Labour version of the pledge cards that were used so successfully by Blair in 1997, because people think he's a bit wishy-washy over, you know, specifics of policy proposals. So it'd be interesting to see whether he goes down that route and whether amongst the great commitments will be lanyards.
OK, thank you very much indeed for your time, chaps, and we'll have another chat next week.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
A former journalist, our special guest this week, has represented Ashford since 1997, carrying out a number of government roles, including that of Deputy Prime Minister during Theresa May's short-lived premiership. And last week, like most of us, he was gobsmacked when his colleague, Dover MP Natalie Elphick, crossed the floor and joined the Labour Party. Welcome, Damien, to the programme.
Hello, Simon.
How are you?
I'm feeling fine, thank you.
You were born in Barry, South Wales, 68 years ago. Your father was in the newspaper business, I seem to remember, and you went and studied at Balliol College, and then you decided on a career in journalism. Why did you decide on journalism?
I think it was probably lack of imagination. As you say, my father was a journalist for most of his career, certainly all the time I was growing up. And so I suppose to some extent it was in the blood. He worked on a number of local and regional papers. As you say, I was born in Wales, but listening to my accent, you wouldn't know that, because at the age of 9, he became the editor of a new local paper they set up in Reading, and we moved there. So I spent my teenage years in the southeast of England, and now sound like that.
So what was your path into journalism then?
I was a BBC trainee. I went into the BBC news training scheme straight out of university, and then became a financial journalist there on The Financial World Tonight, which was a programme that lasted for some time. And from there moved to Channel 4. When it started in 1982, I was one of the first people on Channel 4 News. I did a stint on The Times as well, and then on to an independent production company that produced a programme called Business Daily, which ran at breakfast and midday on Channel 4.
So at what point did your journalistic career, did you decide that it would take the politics path? What prompted that?
It was sort of late 20s, early 30s, where I thought, you know what, I'm more interested in politics than anything else, and I wasn't a political journalist, because I often felt that you shouldn't be that partisan a political journalist. It was these days that looks quite a naive judgment, where quite a lot of journalists spend their entire careers just campaigning for one type of politics or another. But that was less common in those days. So anyway, I thought if you're interested in politics, then it's better to be a player than a spectator anyway. So get involved in politics. So I spent my 30s around the Conservative Party at a local level in West London, where I was living then, and got on the candidates list and got selected. And my first election was in 1992, when I ran against Ken Livingstone.
How did that go then?
Well, I lost. and it was, I describe it as an educational experience, because, you know, there were good and bad things about Ken Livingstone, but he was a very good performer. He was particularly good performing in front of young people and sixth formers and so on. So actually doing meetings sort of against him, as it were, in front of those sorts of audience, were genuinely an educational experience of what to do and what not to do.
Yeah, so there was a bit of a learning curve there. What did you pick up from that particular campaign?
I picked up, don't say anything stupidly ironic. Don't make jokes about yourself, because when they're reprinted in the local paper as straight, you can look an idiot. So you learn to curb your sense of humour in public. But also, sort of more importantly, you know your audience and take all audiences seriously and treat them at the level they want to be treated. And it's so, you know, basically try and avoid as much cliche and waffle as you can. You start having an internal editor in your mind, and as soon as you start thinking, I sound just like a politician here, then you're probably not communicating very effectively.
You obviously got the reasonably safe seat of Ashford back in 1997. Obviously, that was the new Labour landslide. Given the state of the polls at the minute, do you see the same or worse happening again this time around?
You can't tell. I mean, I can read the polls like everyone else, and clearly it's going to be a tough election for us. But as you say, I fought in 1997, which everyone is comparing this with, and we had a majority of 5,500 at the end of that. So I'm working very hard to retain the seat at this time.
Your own seat has always been pretty safe. I mean, you've got a majority of 24,000, which is big even by Conservative terms. But in the recent boundary changes, it's kind of altered its makeup. You've lost some of the villages. I think you lost Tenterden are a part of it. You must be worried that you're going to lose, though.
Well, I've always fought it hard, so it, in a sense, it doesn't make any difference. It's, as you say, all the areas, the villages and Tenterden to the west of Ashford have moved to a new seat called the Weald of Kent. But I gain a lot of rural areas to the east of Ashford. Villages like Sellinge and Elam and Liminge and go as far as Hawkinge. So there's quite a lot of new territory to cover. And that's one of my key aims over the next few months. Indeed, I've been doing it for the last few months, of getting to know people and getting to know those areas, which I've not had much to do with before.
Mm. You would have preferred the Weald of Kent seat. You didn't get it, though, did you, when you stood for...
They said they wanted a new candidate, so, you know, it's fair enough. You stand for things and sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. But I was very pleased that the people in the Ashford Association said, well, you know, well, stay with us then, that would be great. And I was selected very comfortably to be the Conservative candidate in that seat.
Mm. Well, electoral calculus, and that's only a guide, has you only on a 30% chance of winning, whereas Labour are on 68%. And you have, in the mix, you have obviously the Greens, which are strong in Ashford, and you also have the Reform Party. I mean, where do you think those fringy parties might sort of end up affecting the overall result?
I think all experience tells us that at a general election, people tend to vote far less for the smaller parties than they do in local elections because, I mean, for a start, twice as many people vote in a general election as do in a typical local election. So you have a different and much bigger electorate, and people get the point that, well, although obviously they're voting for the individual candidate, they're also helping select the government of the day. And in all elections, that tends to mean that the smaller parties do less well at a general election than they do at local elections.
What do you feel are the big local issues facing the constituents in Kent, particularly the one, the new Ashford patch that you're going to be fighting?
I mean, the big issues are, a lot of them are transport-based. They're obviously trying to keep the M20 as clear as possible is a permanently important thing for people, not just in Ashford, but all the way down to the coast. So, you know, I have learnt the importance of the Roundhill Tunnel to people in Hawkinge, because when that gets closed, as it does sometimes, if the motorway is blocked, then that makes it hellishly difficult to get in and out of Hawkinge. So that's always one. The rail services, I'm fighting very hard to try and get Eurostar to bring the services back to Ashford. I think that's a very important issue. But also jobs and opportunities and so on. I'm very keen on the development of the Newtown Works into not just the film studios that were promised, film and TV studio, but also to have some kind of attachment to Ashford College, so that we can train people up to do all the craft skills that are needed to make TV and movies and so on, which will be, yeah, it's an exciting career to be in. It's a growing industry at which Britain as a country is very successful. I would like very much to see Ashford as one of the centres of that happening in the coming years.
Yeah. The new entry-exit system is due to come in force, I think, on the October the 6th. Now, that's got to have a massive effect on the M20, the A20, other roads all around Kent, should they come in. Now, if Rishi Sunak calls an October election, you may well be have difficulty getting around the county to actually do your campaigning simply because the roads are going to be jammed up. I mean, yes, is that something that worries you?
Funny enough, I noticed that as well. And yes, I have been talking to ministers up to and including David Cameron as Foreign Secretary in recent months, saying, I mean, not just purely for the electoral purposes, but for other purposes as well, let's not have the M20 blocked because of the new EU entry system. And so therefore, the British government is engaged in talking very actively to the French authorities and wider EU authorities about how to make sure that that doesn't happen, and that in the early days of this new system, when you might expect some teething problems, actually the French authorities apply it in a sensible way so that you don't get blockages at Dover or near the tunnel. And as I say, those talks have been going on for some time, and they are still going on. And the Dover Harbour Board, the Port of Dover, is building a whole new area where they can store coaches, because I think this may be a particular problem for coach travel. And so you're going to need somewhere off road to do that, and that's all happening.
Where would that be? Would that be the Western Docks, or
it's basically filling in part of the docks to form a new big standing area? That's the plan, but that won't be available by October because, you know, the length of time building work takes. So there may have to be some kind of mitigation
between October and when that becomes ready. But everyone is working very hard to try and make sure that this scenario of having more miles of queues on the motorway doesn't happen.
Yeah, and obviously you don't want that happening in the middle of a general election campaign.
Yeah, indeed, particularly not that from my personal point of view, but at all really, because this is something we can see coming. So therefore, we can take steps in advance to make sure that we don't have two serious problems in the early days of this new system.
Is there any prospect of Eurostar or any other carrier going to France stopping in Ashford at any time soon?
Well, I think, we've just been discussing the new European entry system, and being realistic, I don't think anything's going to change before then, because everyone involved in cross-channel travel is trying to get that right, and that's the main priority. So I'm working on the basis that when we've got that out of the way, and if there are any teething problems we've got through them, that next year is the key year when we can persuade either Eurostar to do that, or the prospect of one of the other competitor companies that are talking quite seriously about introducing cross-channel services. I would very much welcome that. I think competition is good for any market. And if we had competition between operators across the channel, that would make it all the easier to say to some of them, look, you can have a comparative advantage here. Stop and collect some passengers in Kent as well, to avoid the ridiculous situation we have now where people are having to travel up from Ashford to St Pancras and then travel all the way back again, spending a lot of money to get back to square one, which is nonsense.
Yeah, OK. Turning back to sort of the run into the general election, we have had sort of interest rate changes, falling inflation, tax cuts, the Rwanda scheme, and the latest Rishi Sunak speech, and they don't appear to be turning the polls. If you were in the Prime Minister's shoes, what would you be doing to reverse the fortunes of the Conservative Party presently?
Oh, I think the first thing we need to do is to be a united party. The thing I get from, I'm obviously talking to a lot of people on doorsteps and so on at the moment, and a lot of them are traditional Conservative voters, and they will say, get your act together. They recognise that, as you say, inflation is coming down, we've got growth back in the economy, they approve of the increase in defence spending, they support the Rwanda scheme and so on. But they say, as long as you're a disunited party, then, we're not impressed. And so I think this requires self-discipline on behalf of all my colleagues to say, have your disagreements in private, but actually get behind the government in public and let what is happening in the real world tell its own story of an economy that's turning the corner, and of there is now a clear difference between the two major parties on defence. We're committed to 2.5% of our GDP being spent on defence by 2030, and Labour's not committed to that. And we want the Rwanda scheme up and running, and Labour has said they would stop it on day one. So there are now significant differences between the parties, and if people concentrate on those, then I think that's the point where the poll ratings will start changing.
How surprised were you by the defection of Natalie Elphick to the Labour Party?
I was gobsmacked, because I know that Natalie's politics have always been on the hard right of the Conservative Party, and a few issues on which Natalie hasn't always been very vocally and aggressively well to the right of someone like me. So the idea that she's now sitting in the same party as John McDonnell and people like that is sort of slightly laughable.
Mm. Would you describe her as a political friend?
She was a colleague, and
so not a friend.
We weren't unfriendly. I get on with all my colleagues, but we weren't close ideologically, if you like. As I say, Natalie was well to the right of me on a lot of issues, and stylistically was a very different politician. Natalie was sort of, I think it's fair to say, sort of noisier and more aggressive than the way I tend to do my politics. But then that's why I think everyone, not least in the Labour Party, is shocked to find her on their benches. There are some people who you feel you can see that they might have been on a political journey, but literally Natalie was putting out leaflets in Dover the week before she defected, saying that Keir Starmer's policy on Rwanda would damage our border controls, and then a week later she joined the Labour Party. So I think the polite word I would say is incomprehensible.
Okay, would you describe her as a turncoat?
I don't like personalizing insults. I think one of the things that's really bad about our politics is that it all gets very personal. People reach for abuse and insults too readily. So I won't use words like that. I just can't understand what she's up to.
So you have no idea why she did it? What her motivations?
No, I mean, I haven't spoken to her since for, you know, fairly obvious reasons. She's not about the sort of conservative end of the tea room in Parliament or anything like that anymore. In fact, I haven't seen her in Westminster since her appearance last week. So no, I have no idea why she did what she did.
A couple of quick questions. You're in favour of the government's plan to lift the cap on faith school admissions. Why do you think this is a good move?
Well, I think that many Catholic schools, and I went to a Catholic school for part of my education, are extremely good. And actually, they're particularly good at helping children from disadvantaged backgrounds to achieve a lot of what they want in life. So I think having this artificial restraint on them effectively meant that the Catholic Church didn't fund any new schools for a long time. And I think they do offer a very good education. And so I would like to see more of them.
I mean, does it go far enough for you? Because obviously it seems as though they're fairly modest in terms of the schools that will be eligible.
Well, I mean, there's only, you know, a certain number of Catholics in the country, but I think that this is what this removal of the restriction was what the Catholic Church was asking for in this country. So I think I've welcomed it, as you say, and I think it will make, over the long term, it will make a huge difference to the education of a number of children, and a beneficial change. And that, I think, is ought to be welcomed by everyone.
And just quickly on the party unity, events like we saw last week don't necessarily improve your prospects, do they? Are you anticipating other defectors?
I don't know is the honest answer. I don't think so. I can't see any reason why anyone would, but then I can't see any reason why someone with Natalie Elphick's views would have defected. So I think often defections, you know, don't reflect well on the individual who defects, as well as, well, in the case of Natalie Elphick, proving a bit damaging to both of the major parties. I've never known a defection like it, where the party receiving the defector appeared at least as uneasy as the party from whom the defector went. So I think the response to that might well discourage anyone else who was even thinking about it.
A Labour councillor rang me when the news broke, and he said, "Is it April the 1st?
Yeah.
He said, "I'm absolutely furious." She said she should have joined the Reform Party.
Yes, that remark has been made by quite a lot of people.
Thank you very much for your time, as usual. Nice to speak to you.
Okay, cheers, Paul. Cheers, Simon.
All the best then, Damien. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Cheers. Bye.
Cheers then. Bye. Thanks, everyone, for joining me on this week's podcast. We'll be back next week when we'll be having a chat with the Labour Group Leader at Kent County Council, Dr. Lauren Sullivan. You can follow us on X, formerly Twitter. Just search for the Kent Politics Podcast. Also, don't forget to tune in to KMTV at 5 p.m. each Friday for their politics show. All the best, bye.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.